impression of Alex Jones. I remember doing it where I was saying, you know, doing the whole that weird conspiratorial lisp, the frogs and all that stuff. We can't find it. I don't remember. Did I do it on a live stream? Did I do it in a YouTube clip? If you know where that Alex Jones impression is, we want to clip it. We think it would do well on social media. We just can't find it. So please let me know. Speaking of Alex Jones, he's been found liable for defamation in the Sandy Hook hoax case. We're going to talk about that on today's bonus show and so many other great stories. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
Are we
still taping?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
We're live. We're not taping.
Oh, we're live.
No,
okay.
We're taping.
We're taping? Okay. They want me to do a little promo. And what do I do? I say WRCT. Is that it?
WRCT Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Radio 900.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
RCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
You're listening in at your house, or you're listening in at your car. If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maccabi Selassie.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM. WRCT Pittsburgh.
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP.
Due to a request by computing services, the remainder of this announcement cannot be.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From High
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT
88.3 FM. A radio.
Hi, you're listening to
WRCT
Pittsburgh CMU. This is Sue Garner
and Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
WRCT Soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
dial. Right? Peace.
Hey there, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. That doesn't make any... I mean...
my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!
It is a sad day in which a member who leads a political party in the United States of America cannot bring themselves to say that issuing a depiction of murdering a member of Congress is wrong.
The House votes to censure Republican Congress member Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media where he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We'll hear AOC's speech before the vote. Then to Charlottesville, Virginia, where organizers of the deadly white supremacist Unite the Right rally are on trial. We'll talk to Slate legal analyst Dahlia Lithwick as closing arguments begin.
And all nine of the plaintiffs who were harmed are saying, we want money damages. We want to know who your funding sources are. We want to understand how these networks of hate groups work together.
Finally, the dawn of everything, a new history of humanity. We speak to the archaeologist David Wengrow about his new book with David Graeber, the pioneering anthropologist who died last year just weeks after finishing the epic work. They examine how indigenous cultures contributed greatly to what we've come to understand as so-called Western ideas of democracy and equality. But these contributions have been erased from history.
Nowadays, you constantly read people saying, well, you know, this idea of the Incas having some kind of welfare state is a projection of European categories onto them. Well, actually, it might be the other way around.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House said Wednesday it'll expand U.S. vaccine manufacturing to produce an additional 1 billion doses a year. Critics called the plan a good first step, but said much more needs to be done to end the current pandemic and to stop future outbreaks. Oxfam America said in a statement, quote, manufacturing should be spread around the world, especially Africa, not limited to the U.S. Fewer than 5% of people in low-income countries have received even a single dose of a vaccine. Meanwhile, White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Jeff Zients said Wednesday about 10% of U.S. children aged 5 to 11 have gotten their first COVID shots. He announced another vaccine milestone.
And today we reached the milestone of 80% of Americans 12 and older with at least one shot.
The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 continues to climb across the U.S., with cases rising in 36 states. Nearly 1,100 U.S. residents are dying of the disease on average every day. The House has voted to censure Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media in which he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Biden. Gosar's refused to apologize and retweeted the video just minutes after the House censured him. He then deleted the post less than an hour later. Gosar is the first lawmaker to be censured in more than a decade. He was also stripped of his committee assignments. Just two Republicans voted in favor of the censure, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and Liz Cheney of Wyoming. A man whose horned fur hat, face paint and 6-foot spear made him one of the most recognizable rioters at the deadly January 6th Capitol insurrection was sentenced to 41 months in prison Wednesday. Jacob Chansley, also known as the QAnon Shaman, had pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding. Chansley was among a group that broke into the Senate chamber and left a threatening note to Vice President Mike Pence, which he penned, reading, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." In Kenosha, Wisconsin, jury deliberations continue for a third day in the homicide trial of the white teenage gunman, Kyle Rittenhouse. On Wednesday, Rittenhouse's attorneys again asked for a mistrial, arguing the defense received a lower-quality drone video of the night Rittenhouse shot and killed two protesters and injured one other. The defense said it may have changed its arguments if it had originally viewed the same higher-quality footage that was shown in court during the trial. Judge Bruce Schrader has yet to rule on either mistrial request from the defense, but said he may still do so even after a potential guilty verdict is delivered. In Brunswick, Georgia, Travis McMichael took the stand Wednesday in his own murder trial and claimed he acted in self-defense when he shot and killed Ahmaud Arbery after chasing him down in his truck.
I shot.
Why?
He had my gun. He struck me. It was obvious that he was it was obvious that he was attacking me, that if he would have got the shotgun from me, then it was this is a life or death situation.
Travis McMichael's father, Gregory McMichael, a former police officer, and their neighbor, William Bryan, are also accused of hunting down and killing Arbery, the 25-year-old black man, while he was out for a jog. Hundreds of pastors and clergy members are expected to gather outside the Glynn County Courthouse today in support of Ahmaud Arbery's family. The rally comes after defense attorneys repeatedly objected to the presence of Reverend Jesse Jackson and other religious leaders in the courtroom's gallery, saying they were intimidating the jury. In Oklahoma, the clock is ticking to save the life of death row prisoner Julius Jones, who's scheduled to be executed today at 4 p.m. Central Time unless Governor Kevin Stitt grants him clemency. Julius Jones, a black man, has long maintained his innocence in a 1999 murder, and three people have said in sworn affidavits that Jones' co-defendant, Christopher Jordan, admitted he was responsible for the killing. The Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board has twice voted in favor of commuting Jones' sentence to life in prison with the possibility of parole. On Wednesday, students across Oklahoma City walked out of class in support of Julius Jones. Two of the three men convicted of the 1965 assassination of Malcolm X are being exonerated today. This comes after decades of advocacy on behalf of the men and after a two-year investigation by the Manhattan DA's office and the Innocence Project found that prosecutors, the FBI, and the New York Police Department omitted key evidence around the murder. Muhammad Aziz is 83. He was released on parole in 1985, has been fighting to clear his name. The other man, Khalil Islam, was released in 1987 and died in 2009. Tune into Democracy Now! On Friday for much more on this story. Climate activists have condemned the Biden administration for proceeding with an auction of over 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico for oil and gas extraction. It's the largest ever sale of drilling leases in the Gulf and comes just days after the UN Global Climate Summit wrapped in Glasgow. An attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, "It's hard to imagine a more hypocritical and dangerous thing for the administration to do. It's incredibly reckless and we think unlawful, too," they said. President Biden meets the leaders of Canada and Mexico at the White House today for a face-to-face meeting informally known as the Three Amigos Summit. Canada Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador will announce the redistribution of millions of COVID-19 vaccine doses originally so-called loaned to them by the United States to other countries in the Western Hemisphere. Also on the agenda, the aging Line 5 pipeline, which is operated by the Canadian company Enbridge under the Straits of Mackinac. Prime Minister Trudeau is pushing to keep the pipeline open after Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer ordered it shut down in May over concerns a spill could devastate the Great Lakes. Meanwhile, Trudeau and Mexican President AMLO are opposing a provision of Biden's proposed Build Back Better Act that would create tax credits for electric vehicles produced by union workers in the United States. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is calling on lawmakers to reject a proposed $778 billion Pentagon budget. A 2022 National Defense Authorization Act calls for a $37 billion increase in military spending compared to President Trump's record Pentagon budget. This is Bernie Sanders speaking from the Senate floor Wednesday.
At a time when the scientists are telling us that we face an existential threat in terms of climate change, we are told that we just don't have enough money to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel and create a planet that will be healthy and habitable for our kids and future generations. Just don't have enough money. Yet today, the U.S. Senate will begin consideration of an annual defense budget that cost $778 billion.
In Sudan, soldiers fired tear gas at anti-coup protesters who braved a deadly crackdown on demonstrations to return to the streets Thursday. The protests came a day after security forces opened fire with live ammunition on marchers in the capital, Khartoum, killing 15 people and wounding dozens of others. That brings the death toll to at least 39 since Sudan's military seized power in an October 25th coup. In Washington, D.C., more than 200 protesters were arrested outside the White House Wednesday as they held a nonviolent demonstration calling on President Biden to prioritize federal voting rights protections. It was the second straight day of large-scale protests in Washington. One of those arrested was Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, former head of the NAACP. You can see our interview with him hours before he was detained at democracynow.org. Some 10,000 union workers who produce farm equipment for the John Deere Company have voted to ratify a new six-year contract and will end their month-long strike. 61% of the United Auto Workers members at John Deere voted in favor of the deal, which brings an immediate 10% raise, an $8,500 signing bonus, two future 5% raises and bonuses to workers who meet production targets. Meanwhile, some 40,000 healthcare workers at Kaiser Permanente hospitals across Northern California were poised to begin a sympathy strike this morning in solidarity with hundreds of engineers who've been on picket lines for 2 months demanding better pay. The Centers for Disease Control reports the United States saw more than 100,000 drug overdoses over a 12-month period ending in April, a nearly 30% increase over the previous year. It's the first time annual U.S. overdose deaths reached six figures. Advocates say isolation and stress brought on by the pandemic led to higher rates of drug abuse. Opioids, including the powerful drug fentanyl, accounted for about three-quarters of all overdose deaths. And the winners of the 2021 National Book Awards were announced last night. North Carolina writer Jason Mott won the fiction prize for his novel titled Hell of a Book. Mott's story was inspired by police killings of African Americans in recent years. Harvard University historian Taya Miles won the 2021 nonfiction prize for All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, a Black Family Keepsake. It's a story of a family torn apart by slavery in the mid-19th century. Martina Spada won an award for his book of poetry, Floaters, which honors asylum seekers who've drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande into Texas. Espada read a passage on Democracy Now! In January 2020.
Like a beer bottle thrown into the river by a boy too drunk to cry. Like the shard of a styrofoam cup drained of coffee brown as the river. Like the plank of a fishing boat broken in half by the river, the dead float. And the dead have a name. Floaters, say the men of the Border Patrol, keeping watch all night by the river, hearts pumping coffee as they say the word floaters, soft as a bubble, hard as a shoe, as it nudges the body to see if it breathes, to see if it moans, to see if it sits up and speaks.
Martín Espada, winner of the National Book Award. You can see the whole poem and our interview with him at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House voted to censure Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media where he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Biden. Just two Republicans voted in favor of the censure, Adam Kinzinger, who said he's not going to run again, and Congressmember Liz Cheney. Gosar is the first lawmaker to be censured in more than a decade. He was also stripped of his committee assignments. Gosar has refused to apologize and retweeted the violent video after the censure vote. On Wednesday, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy refused to condemn Gosar and called the censure vote an abuse of power. Shortly after the House Minority Leader spoke, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez addressed the House.
I've been serving in this body just under 3 years. In that 3 years, enormous amount has happened. But in response to the Republican leader's remarks when he says that this action is unprecedented, what I believe is unprecedented is for a member of House leadership of either party to be unable to condemn incitement of violence against a member of this body. It is sad. It is a sad day in which a member who leads a political party in the United States of America cannot bring themselves to say that issuing a depiction of murdering a member of Congress is wrong, and instead decides to venture off into a tangent about gas prices and inflation. What is so hard? What is so hard about saying that this is wrong? This is not about me. This is not about Representative Gosar. But this is about what we are willing to accept. Not just the Republican leader, but I have seen other members of this party advance the argument, including Representative Gosar himself, the illusion that this was just a joke. That what we say and what we do does not matter so long as we claim a lack of meaning. Now, this nihilism runs deep, and it conveys and betrays a certain contempt for the meaning and importance of our work here. That what we do, so long as we claim that it is a joke, doesn't matter. That what we say here doesn't matter, that our actions every day as elected leaders in the United States of America doesn't matter, that this chamber and what happens in it doesn't matter. And I am here to rise to say that it does. Our work here matters. Our example matters. There is meaning in our service. And as leaders in this country, when we incite violence with depictions against our colleagues, that trickles down into violence in this country. And that is where we must draw the line, independent of party, identity, or belief. It is about a core recognition of human dignity and value and worth. So when we talk about, as mentioned in the resolution, that these depictions are part of a larger trend of misogyny and racial misogyny, racist misogyny, this has results in dampening the participation. And so this vote is not as complex as perhaps the Republican leader would like to make folks believe. It's pretty cut and dry. Does anyone in this chamber find this behavior acceptable? Would you allow depictions of violence against women, against colleagues? Would you allow that in your home? Do you think this should happen on a school board? In a city council? In a church? And if it's not acceptable there, why should it be accepted here?
That was Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez prior to the vote to censure Republican lawmaker Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media where he murders her and attacks President Biden. California Congressmember Jackie Speier also spoke Wednesday, co-sponsor of the censure vote. She herself survived the Jonestown massacre in 1978. She was shot 5 times. She was then an aide to Congressmember Leo Ryan, who was assassinated during the massacre.
I take no pleasure in introducing this resolution. No one asked me to introduce it. No one tapped me on the shoulder. I am a victim of violence. I know what it's like. I also was in the gallery clamoring for life when the shots rang out in the speaker's lobby. We're here today because a sitting member thought it was okay to post a deranged, animated video of himself killing a fellow member of this House and also attacking the President of the United States. That video has been seen by 3 million people. It was up for over 2 days before it was taken down. Inciting violence begets violence. Congressman Ocasio-Cortez has become the go-to subject of the radical right to stir up their base, as too often is the case for women of color. It is disgusting and profoundly unacceptable. Tragically, the minority leader has not condemned the video. For 8 days, he said nothing. Silence speaks volumes. Silence normalizes violence. Violence against women in politics is a global phenomenon. A 2016 survey by the Interparliamentary Union found that 82% of women parliamentarians have experienced psychological violence, and 44% have received threats of death, rape, beatings, or abduction. The intent of these online threats against women is clear. Silence them. Strip them of their power and discourage them from running for office.
California Congressmember Jackie Speier speaking before the 223-207 vote to censure Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media where he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Biden. After the rare censure vote, Congressman Gosar retweeted the video. Coming up, The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity by David Wengrow and the late David Graeber, who died last year, weeks after finishing the epic work. But first, we go to Charlottesville, where organizers of the deadly white supremacist rally are on trial. We'll speak to Slate legal analyst Dahlia Lithwick. Stay with us. Progress by Idols. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, jurors in Charlottesville, Virginia, are hearing closing arguments today in the civil trial that seeks to hold white supremacists accountable for organizing the deadly Unite the Right rally in 2017 and conspiring to commit racially motivated violence. Several hundred white supremacists marched with tiki torches at the time across the University of Virginia, chanting, "You will not replace us, Jews will not replace us, and white lives matter." The next day, self-described neo-Nazi James Alex Fields slammed his car into a crowd of anti-racist counter-protesters, killing Heather Heyer, and injuring dozens more. He was sentenced to life in prison for murder and hate crimes and lost an appeal this week. Two of the white supremacists have been defending themselves in the courtroom, Richard Spencer and Christopher Cantwell. They took the stand Tuesday and tried unsuccessfully to have the judge dismiss the case for lack of evidence, even as they used racial slurs during the trial. When Cantwell cross-examined one of the witnesses, Holocaust historian Deborah Lipstadt, he asked her, quote, "There's no such thing as an innocent anti-Semitic joke." After today's closing arguments, jurors are expected to begin deliberations Friday. For more, we're joined by Dahlia Lithwick, Slate.com senior editor and senior legal correspondent. She's been covering the trial, lived in Charlottesville during the Unite the Right rally. Her recent piece is headlined, "Why the Nazis Are Treating Their Trial in Charlottesville Like a Joke." Dahlia, welcome back to Democracy Now! We're in this key moment of three, one might argue, white supremacist trials. This one is a civil one. You've got Rittenhouse, and then you've got the case of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. But we're going to start with Charlottesville. Talk about the uniqueness of this trial, that it's civil, and what has been said, and the fights between the white supremacists who are representing themselves.
One of the things that is really striking about this trial is the extent to which we all thought that the defendants were going to be somewhat organized. They were going to present a kind of coherent front. They were going to at least attempt to prove to the world that what they did was innocent. What we've seen instead is just chaos. The plaintiff's case was airtight, so much documentary evidence, reams and reams of testimony, compelling testimony. And then when the defense kind of got up to try to present its case at the beginning of this week, it was infighting, catfighting. At one point, Richard Spencer was questioning Jason Kessler, the local organizer, about why he thought he was a psycho. As you said, the N-word was being dropped. Chris Cantwell, the so-called crying Nazi, was literally standing up and replaying video of himself assaulting people. And so one of the real lessons of this trial to me is that when given 4 years to prepare a defense, these entities and people, all they could come up with was performance art, showmanship, and a little bit of what you heard about Paul Gosar. Just, this is a joke. It's fun. This was hilarious. Don't you agree?
Dahlia, you mentioned the plaintiffs, their testimony. What most struck you about what they said?
I think it's hard not to be moved by the trauma. You had one plaintiff after another, some of whom sustained life-changing injuries, some of whom have sustained the kind of post-traumatic stress that has rendered them almost incapacitated, really unbelievably tragic trauma. And when you heard them talk about what they sustained that day, how it has informed and affected their lives and really made them terrified, and then to see them being cross-examined again by the Chris Cantwells of the world, the Richard Spencers of the world, trying to imply that they were part of some nefarious Antifa plot and that this was a trap laid by anti-fascists in order to discredit the white supremacist movement. I think the thing that has struck me most is just the discordance, again, between the genuine life-altering suffering of the plaintiffs and the sense that this is just kind of a comedy tour, that it is neither serious nor sober nor warranting of action on the part of the defendants.
Dahlia, could you explain who is Richard Spencer and who is Cantwell?
Well, Richard Spencer rose to fame shortly after Donald Trump was elected. He was, for a moment, the poster boy of the freshly scrubbed, preppy, new face of white supremacy. He's credited with inventing the term alt-right, which was supposed to be freshly scrubbed Nazi. And you may remember right after the election, he led a sort of victory party where people gave the Nazi salute and shouted Nazi slogans. That's Richard Spencer. I should note, he's fallen from grace. He's now representing himself. His wife left him with allegations of terrific abuse, and he's penniless. Chris Cantwell, I think, rose to fame around the same time as a shock jock, as an entertainer. He mentions every opportunity that he can in this trial, that he has a entertainment product, this podcast, that he's just a funny, funny guy who happened to show up in Charlottesville armed, and who, after he was pepper sprayed as part of the violence, there was a video of him that went viral of him sobbing and crying about turning himself into the police. So I think, in a sense, both of them are iterations of this face of what tried to be kind of cool, hip, proud boy era, you know, funny, entertaining Nazis who a little bit got caught up in their own rhetoric and really failed utterly to take responsibility for the roles they played in leading this movement and possibly, well, the jury will tell us, leading to some of the violence that day.
Dahlia, what do you think the broader significance of this case are, and also the closing arguments as they're set to begin today? What are you watching out for?
So one of the things I want to really note is that this trial was not televised. In order to listen in, you have to call a 1-800 number that takes you into the courthouse. So it actually has been a really fascinating study in how to cover Nazism without amplifying it. Certainly some of the defendants who've been deplatformed have been going on one another's podcasts. But one of the things that's been really striking is the extent to which it has contained some of the worst rhetoric, the dropping of the N-word, the joking with one another about which Holocaust jokes are funny. All of that has been kind of hived off from public view. And I think, in a sense, for me, one of the lessons of this is how you can have accountability. And again, it will be left to the jury starting this afternoon when they begin to deliberate if they want to have accountability. But to have accountability without amplifying the really hateful, hurtful message, I think it's been a really powerful lesson how you do that, how you don't, in some sense, give attention to the worst elements of this. In terms of the closing statements, I think one of the things that I've found really interesting in the last 2 days is the extent to which the defendants simply don't understand conspiracy law. There was an attempt on Tuesday. They wanted the case dismissed. Richard Spencer and Chris Cantwell said to the judge, "We have nothing to do. There was no agreement. There's no evidence that we were in a conspiracy." And Judge Moon, who's this 84-year-old, very Southern gentleman who's been really unfailingly fair to both sides, basically said, "You don't understand anything about conspiracy law," and walked them through the evidence and more or less said that alone could lead the jury to find conspiracy. So I think whether the defendants fully understand the law and fully understand the extent to which they're on the hook is going to be the thing that I'm going to look for in the closing.
Very quickly, before we move on to the Rittenhouse homicide trial, the murder trial, explain how this case is different. They are not on trial, for example, for killing Heather Heyer, or this is a civil trial. They're not going to go to jail. So what is the point? Who are the plaintiffs that brought this?
The plaintiffs were 9 people who were injured in the events of August 11th and 12th in Charlottesville. And it's a civil trial in some sense because the Trump Justice Department didn't stand up and didn't in any way attempt to bring to justice the folks who were involved in organizing and performing this rally. And so I think that the plaintiffs in this case, and they're led by really masterful attorneys, Robbie Kaplan and Karen Dunn and their teams, what they essentially said was, "We will be the stand-in for the DOJ. We will bring a civil rights action that says if you, based on racial animus, deprive people of their civil rights." This is rooted in the KKK Act, 150-year-old statute. "We will effectuate your rights in a civil trial."
I want to ask you about the homicide trial of the white teen gunman, Kyle Rittenhouse, where jury deliberations have entered a third day. Judge Bruce Schrader has yet to rule on two mistrial requests from the defense, but said he may still do so. He said he could rule on this even after a verdict is rendered. So if there was a guilty verdict, he could move to vacate it. Dahlia Lithwick, you are Slate's senior legal correspondent and have another piece out headlined, "When Everything is Self-Defense and Everyone Gets a Gun." It seems to me that could apply as much to the Arbery murder trial, where Travis McMichael, the son of the former police officer and his father and the other man, Brian, are also on trial for murdering, in this case, Ahmaud Arbery, and they're contending self-defense. But talk about Rittenhouse and self-defense.
I think you made this point in your lead-in, Amy, that we have now reached a moment where people are claiming self-defense when they bring their own weapon, in Rittenhouse's case, across state lines, a weapon he was not legally entitled to own. They bring their weapon into a public setting, and then they claim self-defense because they feel that their weapon was going to be used against them. And you cited the Arbery case for that. But Rittenhouse, too, is laying claim to this idea that he was in danger and entitled to shoot all these people in the span of 120 seconds because they were going to wrest his rifle, his weapon from him, and they were going to kill him with it. And the point I was trying to make, and I think this is really connected to the U.S. Supreme Court hearing oral argument just a few weeks ago in a case that would probably strike down New York's licensing law, is that if everybody has a weapon and everybody feels that their weapon can be used against them and then forward a self-defense claim, everybody will be reasonable. It is entirely reasonable in a world where everybody is armed and everybody thinks that they're vulnerable because someone else will shoot them with their own gun, that everyone will shoot first. It doesn't seem like a civil society. It seems like the OK Corral to me. And really, in a deep, deep sense, the Rittenhouse jurors have to confront the fact that it may have been perfectly reasonable for him to feel that he was under threat because his own weapon could be used against him. But what does that say about a world in which everyone will use that as a claim of self-defense?
For being with us, Slate.com senior editor, senior legal correspondent. We will link to all your coverage when we come back. The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity by David Wengrow and the late David Graeber. Stay with us.
And read your morning papers, read every single line, and tell me if you can believe that simple world you find. Read every slanted word till your eyes are getting sore. Yes, I know you're set for fighting, but what are you fighting for? Listen to your leaders, the ones that won the race, as they stand there right before you and lie into your face. If you ever try to buy them, you know what they stand for. I know you're set for fighting, but what are you fighting for? Put ragged clothes upon your back and sleep upon the ground, and tell police about your rights as they drag you down, and ask them as they lead you to some deserted door. Yes, I know.
What are you fighting for? By Phil Oakes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to a groundbreaking new book. It's titled The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. It's written by the late anthropologist David Graeber and the archaeologist David Wengrow. The book examines how indigenous cultures contributed greatly to what we've come to understand as so-called Western ideas of democracy and equality. But these contributions have been erased from history. After years of research, the two men completed the book in the summer of 2020, just weeks before David Graeber died unexpectedly at the age of 59 on vacation in Venice, Italy. Graeber was a highly influential anthropologist, a veteran of the international anti-capitalist movement that pushed for a different vision of globalization. His book, Debt, the first 5,000 years, made the case for sweeping debt cancellation. He also helped organize the Occupy Wall Street protests. September 17, 2011, was credited with helping to coin the phrase, "We are the 99%. In both his academic and activist work, David Graeber looked at ways to radically recreate society. This is David Graeber speaking on Democracy Now! Just 2 days after Occupy began.
So I ended up helping to facilitate a meeting which was at least 2,000 people. It was mostly young people, and most of them were people who'd gone through the educational system, who were deeply in debt, and who found it completely impossible to get jobs. I mean, these people have felt really feel very strongly that they did the right thing. They did exactly what they were supposed to. The system has completely failed them, and they're not going to be saved by the people in charge. You're just going to if there's going to be any kind of society like we worth living in, we're going to have to create it ourselves.
That was the late David Graeber in 2011. We're joined now by his dear friend and co-author, David Wengrow. The two co-wrote The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. David Wengrow is joining us from London, where he's a professor of comparative archaeology at University College London. David, thanks so much for joining us. Our condolences on the death of David, just as you finished this book. You know, David lived just down the street from Democracy Now! Studios and the ILG houses, the International Lady Garment Workers housing complex that's just about a block from here, which so much shaped him. Can you talk about, well, just start with the title, The Dawn of Everything, and this new narrative that you both want to bring to the world?
Well, we really started exchanging ideas around the time that you were describing, the time of the Occupy movement. So around 2011, we exchanged books. David gave me the debt book that you mentioned there, Amy. I gave him a book I'd written on ancient civilizations. And we started swapping ideas. We were interested in how our fields, so I'm an archaeologist, as you mentioned, David was an anthropologist, how we could contribute to debates on social inequality, which had really been escalating since the financial crash of 2008. Initially, we planned to write something quite short, really a sort of pamphlet, just to introduce readers to major discoveries from our fields that we felt hadn't really escaped out of the academy into wider consciousness. Firstly, this very conventional idea that before human beings invented agriculture, we lived almost exclusively in tiny egalitarian bands of hunter-gatherers. It's not true. It's actually wildly inaccurate. There simply was no such period of prolonged political innocence. And secondly, the equally conventional and entrenched idea that our species became trapped in inequality through the invention of agriculture and then later cities. That's not true either. Actually, what the broad sweep of history shows is that living in large-scale, densely populated, technologically sophisticated societies really doesn't require people to simply give up social freedoms in the way that we're often told it does. As you can probably gather by now, this was already getting beyond a short pamphlet.
And David, one of the critical points that your book makes is that the encounter between indigenous intellectuals and early European colonists was very important to what we now refer to as the Enlightenment, ideas of democracy and of inequality. And one of the central figures you name is Kondiaronk, a 17th, late 17th century indigenous intellectual. So could you explain who he was and what his example illustrates about this broader history of the encounter between European colonists and indigenous peoples?
Yes. Well, it goes back to the first question, really. We realized there was something fundamentally strange about the fact that human history is conventionally framed in this way about a question about the origins of inequality. Where does the question come from? I mean, it already assumes that there's something else, an age of equals or an age of freedom. And tracing it back to its origins, they really go back to an essay competition. In 1753, a French academy poses that question. What is the origin of social inequality? And reflecting on this, we realized this is strange. We're talking about France before the revolution, one of the most hierarchical societies on earth. Why do people already assume that things were once different? And following that line of inquiry led us, as you say, to the Americas and this encounter between European colonists and indigenous societies, particularly around the region of the Great Lakes of what's now Canada. And Kandiyohonk, I mean, it was in that area that Europeans first encountered entire societies built on principles of social freedom that were still completely alien to European civilizations at the time. And Kandiyohonk was very much a product of that social milieu. He was a leading figure in Wendat society at the time. He was one of the signatories in 1701 of the Great Peace of Montreal. Apart from being a warrior and a diplomat, he was clearly regarded by almost everyone who met him, Europeans and indigenous people, as simply one of the most intelligent people they'd ever met, a great thinker, a great orator. And he was routinely invited to the fort, the table of the then French governor of that part of the colonies, to engage in debates with Europeans on topics that ranged from Christianity to marriage customs, the role of money, and the whole idea of political freedoms. And many of these conversations were recorded, and in them, Kandiyohonk launches a truly stinging critique of European behavior. There's a lot about women's freedoms. There's a lot about the obsession with wealth and money as forms of power. There are many observations on poverty and the kind of endemic homelessness that was apparent already then in European towns, colonial towns included. And there's a lot of discussion, a lot of criticism of the way that Europeans are constantly, on the one hand, competing with each other, but also deferring to each other on the basis of rank and status, which seems to have been a principle that was alien and absent from Iroquoian-speaking societies at the time. So if a Wendat chief wanted to engage people in some kind of collective project, there was no real way to command or coerce, so it was all really predicated on persuasion. And it was widely observed by Jesuit missionaries and others at the time that people would sit in the village plaza for long hours each day debating and trying to convince each other and reach consensus on the issues of the time. And it's actually not contested that Europe, in the Age of Enlightenment, adopted important cultural habits from the Americas, smoking tobacco from pipes, drinking caffeinated beverages. But for some reason, it never seems to occur to historians to ask if we also borrowed concepts and ideas. And in the book, we try to show that that's exactly what happened. And Kandiyohonk is really a product of that culture, which influenced Europe in quite profound ways.
And also, I mean, one of the things that's very striking about the book is precisely what you say here, that, you know, there was from Kandiyohonk and presumably others too, these critiques of European society at the time. Could you explain why you think these critiques have been all but entirely erased from the records, from historical records?
It's a very interesting question because from time to time over the last few decades, historians, some of them, like the historian George Tsui, who is in fact himself of the Huron-Wendat Nation with a PhD in history, have drawn attention to these sources. But for reasons that I can't really explain, that really reflect, I think, very poorly on our institutions and on the academy, they have been marginalized. And one thing we try to do in our book is really shine a light on that existing scholarship.
I'd like to go back to 2018 when David Graeber talked about the dawn of everything. It was during a teach out outside your school, the University College London.
We started saying, well, maybe the inequality question, if we just move that aside, what is the real question? Isn't where did the inequality come from? Or where did the hierarchy come from? It's like, how did we get stuck in one mode?
Right.
Because it's very different having a police force. If you're going to be in the police force this year, but next year you will, and next year, year after that you will, and you know, so they're not. People aren't going to behave the same in a hierarchy. If that hierarchy is going to get ripped down for half the year, and everybody has to deal with each other, right, as equals.
So that's the late David Graeber. David Wengrow, you're sitting right next to him outside your school. And so if you can explain the current debates about both democracy and equality and how they are really explained differently in the dawn of everything in this new history of humanity.
Well, it's interesting and a bit painful to listen to that clip for many reasons, one of which is that we're going to be on strike again in a few weeks' time over exactly the same issue. What David's describing there is one of the major things that came out of our research, which is that human beings, for most of the history of our species, has simply been a much more playful and experimental species than we tend to give ourselves credit for, including a propensity to simply invent and experiment with different forms of political arrangements. Once you realize this is the case, the question itself changes. We start thinking differently about the big questions of human history. If it's not about the origins of inequality, so if we do away with this false notion that there was once this society of equals, what is it then about? And what David's talking about in that clip is really the other question that then comes into view, which is, how did we get stuck in a situation where these days we find it almost impossible to even imagine, let alone put into effect, other forms of social arrangements? And how stuck are we, really, in that respect? And I think the first step towards answering that question is precisely to examine the big story that we tell about the history of our species and about human capacities in general. So what we're trying to do in the book is really blow away the cobwebs of all these outdated theories and basically myths which persuade us that the kinds of inequality we have today are in fact an inevitable result of social evolution. And once you take those things away, what you're left with is really people making everyday decisions. That in itself seems to us an important step in getting unstuck.
And talk about the argument you make around war and competition, that it is not evolutionarily rooted in human beings. It's not inevitable. Talk about this different view of history when it comes to war.
Well, when you look directly at the evidence, and we do have pretty good evidence, direct evidence these days for things like rates of violence and interpersonal conflict and injuries in the archaeological record, what you see, the way I would put it is that, warfare and violence can be traced very, very far back in the history of our species, but they're no more inevitable in that body of evidence than periods of peace. Periods of violence and war come and they go. So one can't say that we're innately warlike and competitive any more or less than you can say we are innately altruistic and cooperative. The question which really emerges from the book is why it is that at certain points in history, violence including warfare, has a more profound and durable effect than at others. In other words, why passing acts of violence, which are obviously always traumatic, but they don't always become structural. They don't always become embedded in the fabric of homes and family life, some of the other things you've touched on already in your show today. And that became a real focus of the book and a focus of trying to understand how it is that our societies have got to the stage where we do feel trapped and stuck. And simply by diagnosing the problem better, we feel that that in itself is important in reflecting on how one can then untangle oneself from those kinds of violence.
Could you explain, David, also the, you know, from David Graeber's clip that we just played, how this conception of war and violence also has something to do with the fact of hierarchies being fluid in the way that your book shows and that David spoke about, that people who were occupied powerful positions did not occupy them in perpetuity, meaning not even in the same year, that there was a constant shift between those who were in power and those who were not.
This is an excellent example of what I was talking about in the sense of the experimental nature of human politics. When we think about hunter-gatherer societies, we tend to think of perhaps one or two basic forms of egalitarian society. Actually, what we found is that there's really a large literature on societies that some of them practiced agriculture, some didn't, that actually used to flip or alternate their social systems on a seasonal basis. One of the examples in the book, which David was referring to there, were the Plains Nations of North America, which at a certain time of year, it was the time of year when the bison, the buffalo, came through on their seasonal migrations, would form into a kind of society that in some respects resembles what we today would call a state. There was a police force, there were squads of soldiers who had full coercive powers. If anyone endangered the success of the hunt, they could be whipped, they could be imprisoned, they could even be killed. But the point about this, well, there's two points. First of all, is that the individuals who occupied those roles, those coercive roles, rotated on an annual or biennial basis, so you could actually be confronting the person who you've whipped, imprisoned, punished the next year, but from the other end of the process. And the second is that these societies with their coercive institutions didn't last beyond the period of the hunting season and the sundance rituals which followed. And actually for the rest of the year, these plain societies would split off into demographically smaller groups which had entirely different moral systems and actually where coercion wasn't permitted and people would have to resolve disputes through processes of deliberation and debate.
David, you write also in the book, just to look at the context of the arguments that you make in this, you know, quite monumental work, 700 pages long, that the book began as an appeal to ask better questions. So, you know, as academics, journalists, activists committed to social justice and greater levels of equality, what are the questions that we should be asking?
Well, as you mentioned, David was deeply involved in the global justice movement. And at least as I perceive it, the central question of that movement is whether our current cultural system, with all of its issues, including issues of sustainability and the climate crisis, whether this is really basically the only way that we can organize our societies today, or whether there are, in fact, viable alternatives. And as an anthropologist and an archaeologist, it's a very logical thing to do, is then to look, simply look at all the other ways that humans have, in fact, organized themselves over the whole span of our species' history. And when you do that in the light of modern scientific evidence, other questions and other possibilities do in fact come to light. For example, questions about sustainable cities. Actually, it turns out that for many centuries or even thousands of years, we have evidence now of really large-scale, densely populated societies which lived in cities that were essentially decentralized in terms of their decision-making processes. We have examples of mass societies which managed to organize themselves without reducing people to numbers in a queue. So they don't have the kind of impersonal bureaucracies that we just sort of take for granted today and feel are kind of inevitable. And we also have some really striking examples, including one from pre-Columbian Central America, from Mexico.
David, we have 5 seconds.
Of systems of democracy, which were based on the principle of containing one's ego rather than flaunting one's ego.
We're going to have to leave it there, David. I thank you so much for being with us. But people can get it in the book by David Wengrow and the late David Graeber, The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2127 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYW LP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. I am your host, Mando Richard, and throughout the next 2 hours, we've got a mixture of music that I know you will enjoy. We'll start off like we usually do on the liquored up side of the family. We'll end up on the gospel side of the family, and in between, chaos will rule. We're also going to hear from Dennis McCurdy, who's going to be appearing live in Pittsburgh coming up real soon, and remember, when you hear it, and we're talking about a concert in Pittsburgh, you be sure to support live music wherever you are. Delaware, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Michigan, West Virginia, wherever you might be. Let's get things started. Here comes Dave Inslee and the Careless Smokers, West Texas Wine.
Well, they say that there's gold buried in those hills, the devil rides a horse so fine. All I remember from my time down there is a taste of West Texas wine. Liars and cheaters and Jesus goats, the souls of dying men, wander the streets of Presidio and the hills down around Big Bend. They say John Glenn had a taste for blood, maybe that he lost his mind. But the story I hear from my time down there, he was drunk on West Texas wine. Bobcat Carter was the last outlaw. Everybody knew his name. The lights in the sky are a maiden's tear. The desert can drive you insane. Many men died coming through those hills, looking for the haystack mine. All the wealth that you need can be had for free. It's in the taste of West Texas wine. something dark and sweet. Try a taste of West Texas wine. Everybody has a favorite drink. Reckon that you know what's mine. It's as dark and sweet as those bloody streets. Try a taste of West Texas wine. Well, I woke up in a pool of sweat on the towel by the bathroom floor. Somebody wrote murder on the hotel mirror. I remember from the night before. Spent the night fighting with a drunken ghost. My hands were bloody and sore. So I had me a drink and it tasted sweet. So I had about two or three more. They say that there's gold buried in those hills, and the devil rides a horse so fine. All I remember from my time down there is a taste of West Texas wine.